Now, when I first started talking about the switches to people that would attend lectures, I called them what they were. I called them IMP switches comprised of receptors and effectors. And I could see, obviously, that really tickled everybody's fancy because as I provided the name of that switch in scientific terms, everybody just looked at me with staring eyes going, what's he talking about? It's one of those complex scientific terminology things again. And I realized that really wasn't an adequate way to describe the switch. So I started to look at describing a switch by defining its function. And the definition of the switch is easily derived by defining the function of the receptor and defining the function of the effector. The receptor, the function is very obvious. You're familiar with it yourself. It's awareness of the environment. That's what your receptors provide. Your eyes, your ears, your nose. These are providing information to you about what's going on in the environment. The protein receptors on the cell membrane provide to the cell information as to what's going on in the environment. So it provides awareness of the environment. The effector does something different, though. The effector sends a physical signal into the cell to engage any of the physiological mechanisms that would be appropriate in response to that signal. So the function of the effector is to provide a physical sensation. So when I defined the structure of the membrane in trying to provide the audience with what it really represents, I defined the membrane switch we've been talking about as an awareness of the elements of the environment through a physical sensation. What was totally interesting was this is the exact same definition used for a particular word that was already in the dictionary that most everybody was familiar with. The word is perception. This is the exact definition of perception, an awareness of the elements of the environment through a physical sensation. And all of a sudden, I called the switch perception. And all of a sudden, everybody in the audience started to understand right away what I was talking about. Perception controls behavior. The switch, the awareness of the elements of the environment, then engaging the effector, which sends a physical sensation, connects an environmental signal to a biological behavior. The switch is called perception. And therefore, when I told the audience, perception controls behavior, everyone immediately understood what I said. And what was really interesting is by the time we really get to this part of the discussion, and we're talking about behavior being controlled, you might realize something. We haven't even talked about DNA. The issue is, life isn't controlled by DNA. DNA is a blueprint to make the proteins, but the proteins aren't controlled by the DNA. The proteins are controlled by the signals of the environment, which are mediated by the perception. So the first real hard conclusion in the nature of life in the study that we've been talking about right now is perception controls behavior, which simply implies an environmental signal is picked up by a switch called perception, which then directs a signal to a protein mechanism inside the cell that creates a biological function that will respond to the signal in the environment. So all of a sudden, it's like, wow, life isn't controlled by genes. No, it's controlled by the signals in the environment. And this is very interesting because I observed this in my cultures of stem cells. That in creating the culture of stem cells, one of the first things you do is digest the tissue to free up the cells. But in the digestion process using enzymes, the enzymes clip off the receptor proteins. And so as I'm preparing my cell cultures, one of the first things that happens is the receptor proteins are lost from the surface of the cell. The cell can't read the environment, for at that moment, the receptors are defective. Interesting point. When the cell cannot respond to the environment, it remains as a little round ball. It doesn't express any behavior whatsoever. That the cell does not express behavior until such time that the metabolism occurring inside the cell leads to the replacement of the receptors that were lost by the enzymes. Once the receptors start to appear back on the surface of the cell then engages in behavior. So in a very interesting point, when the cell cannot respond to the environmental signals, the cell does not express behavior. The signals and behavior are tightly integrated upon one another. So now we've gotten to the point. Behavior, yes, controlled by the environmental signal, and behavior is created through the action of the proteins in the cytoplasm. But then here comes an interesting point. As I said, there are over 100,000 different proteins. A cell does not make all of the proteins all of the time. It makes the proteins that it needs to use. Well, consider this possibility that a cell is in the environment and a signal shows up that wasn't there before and the cell has to make a response, but now it doesn't have the proteins in the cytoplasm to make that response. And yet the signal is at the door knocking on the perception switch saying, okay, I'm out here, and the cell has to make a response. Now the question is, what does the cell do when it doesn't have the protein? Aha! This is where we bring in the genes, because the genes are the blueprints to make the proteins. But the question is this: how does a gene know when it should offer its blueprint to make a protein? The genes don't see the world. The genes are encapsulated and closed within the nucleus and have no visibility or awareness of what's really going on in the world. In that regard, genes don't know what should be activated and which proteins should be made and which ones should not be made themselves. That the genes are not self-actualizing. And this is very interesting, because if we talk to conventional biologists or read the current literature, we always hear phrases such as a gene turned on, a gene turned off, giving us the impression that genes are intelligent units, that genes have the ability to respond to the world that they live in by observing that world and making responses through an intelligence, something like a self-actualization. The interesting part is, these are all words based on the original belief from the central dogma that genes control life, that genes are the active component. That was perceived in the dogma. And ever since then, we bought into the concept of genetic determinism. Genes are controlling life. Every time we invoke the concept that a gene expresses control, we're suggesting that the gene is able to self-actualize, that it has a consciousness or an intelligence to it to allow it to turn on or turn off. Well, this, as I said, is what we bought from our belief that genes were actually in control. But the reality is, genes are not in control. We have already demonstrated that by the fact that we could remove the genes from a cell and the behavior is still there. But now we can understand why that occurred, because the proteins are in the cell and the proteins are controlled by the perception switches, and therefore the genes weren't even necessary, and that's why enucleating the cell didn't really cause a problem. However, the cells ultimately did die when the nucleus was gone. And the question is, well, then what was the role of that nucleus? And the answer is simply this: the genes provide the blueprints to make the proteins that comprise the machinery of the cell. That if I remove the nucleus, I remove the blueprints. The cell can still go along as long as it has the proteins. However, if a protein breaks down, which they normally do through wear and tear, just like any machine, when the proteins break down, I need to replace them. If there's no nucleus, then there are no blueprints. And so in a nucleated cell, when the proteins break down, there is no recourse to identify how to make a new protein. And when enough proteins break down that interfere with the vital functions of the cell, that's when the cell will begin to die if it doesn't have genes. So the cells die not because the nucleus was removed and interfered with the operation of the cell. The cells die when they're enucleated because at some point down the line, when I need to replace a protein that is vital for the function, I don't have the gene blueprint to do so. The cells without a nucleus can't reproduce their parts or themselves. So interesting point is, removing the nucleus prevents reproduction. And when you understand that, you realize, my goodness, in all the books, we've given the nucleus the responsibility of being the brain. But in truth, the nucleus is just the gonad. The nucleus is the reproductive element. Now, if we look at the nucleus as a gonad and how it applies to reproduction, then we go back and have to say, let's look at those chromosomes, because the chromosomes contain the DNA where the blueprints are. Well, the interesting part, if you can recall from the earlier discussion, is that chromosomes are made out of 50% protein and 50% DNA. And in 1944, when Avery McLeod McCarty revealed that the DNA was the element that controlled the traits, protein biochemists lost out. Nobody cared about the proteins. Everybody wanted to deal with the DNA. So all subsequent experiments from the late 40s onwards really involved this: isolating the genetic material, the chromosomes, from the cell, separating the components of the chromosomes, the proteins, from the DNA, saving the DNA to do the molecular genetic experiments, and throwing away the proteins. So for 50 years, we threw away the proteins, which constitute about 50% of the nucleus.